Hello and welcome to our program Business News, brought to you by Owl Radio and the Low Vision Resource Center. I am Vanessa, and during the next half hour, I will be reading articles from the business section of the San Antonio Express News here on Owl Radio. Our first article is titled "Combative Lawyer Quits Practicing" by Patrick Danner. Risk-taking San Antonio attorney Phil Ross has quietly resigned from practicing law to avoid facing discipline from the State Bar of Texas, including possible disbarment. Ross, known for his contrarian and sometimes combative style, submitted his resignation in late February, 2 days before a court hearing in which a judge was to consider sanctioning him for engaging in acts of professional misconduct. The resignation became effective March 7th by order of the Texas Supreme Court, marking an unceremonious end to a nearly 35-year legal career. Ross, who is 73, said the decision to give up his law license allows him to retire with a clean record. "I decided just not to take any more chances and, with the guillotine hanging over my neck, go ahead and retire and not be beheaded," he said. The State Bar of Texas sued Ross 3 times in about 2.5 years over allegations of serial misconduct, including in guardianship cases involving an elderly person. He defended himself in the actions but conceded defeat after judges in 2 of the cases found that he had violated bar rules and engaged in conduct that involved dishonesty, fraud, deceit, or misrepresentation. A sanctions hearing in one of the cases had been scheduled for February 27th, but was canceled after Ross agreed to resign. A bar spokeswoman declined to comment. That case stemmed from Ross's role in a high-profile Bexar County case involving millionaire Charles Thrash, who's 85 years old, the longtime owner of CT Thrash Differential and Axle Service on West Avenue. In 2018, a Bexar County probate court found Thrash to be mentally incapacitated and appointed guardians to care for him. The bar alleged that Ross repeatedly tried to represent him when the lawyer knew Thrash lacked the mental capacity to hire an attorney. Ross also allegedly took him out of Bexar County, contrary to court orders, to obtain a license for an impermissible marriage to his girlfriend, Laura Martinez. The marriage was later annulled. In addition, Ross was accused of being involved with Thrash's subsequent improper adoption of 2 of Martinez's adult children, which was later reversed. Ross countered that court orders on Thrash's guardianship were an error and should be reversed on appeal. The evidence of Ross's professional misconduct related to Thrash's guardianship is shockingly extensive, compelling, and clear, the state bar said in a June motion asking the court to grant partial summary judgment that he had violated its rules. A judge granted the motion in November and set the February hearing on sanctions. Ross argued that a jury should determine sanctions. The Fourth Court of Appeals in San Antonio declined to hear his argument, so he went to the Texas Supreme Court, where the matter was pending when he agreed to resign. "I saw all the cards were stacked against me," Ross said. He was convinced that he could have gotten any sanctions against him reversed on appeal, but said there was no remedy for recovering damages for being wrongfully disciplined. "The sanction could have been as light as a public reprimand or as severe as disbarment," he said. The bar's March 2020 suit was sparked by a grievance filed by Tanya Barina, Thrash's great-niece and one of his guardians. Ross had linked the bar's complaint to the release of an episode of the Netflix series Dirty Money, which was critical of the guardians in the Thrash case. The episode first aired 6 days before the lawsuit. Barina filed a defamation case against Ross, Netflix, and others over the series. A state district court judge in San Antonio denied a motion to dismiss a case, a decision upheld by the Fourth Court of Appeals. Netflix has appealed to the Texas Supreme Court, where the case is pending. Carl Kolb, Barinas' attorney, could not immediately be reached for comment. Our next article is titled Online Grocer Marty Starting Texas Service by Madison Isler. Marty, an online grocery store selling pantry staples that might otherwise go into landfills, has opened a warehouse in Dallas and rolled out delivery to San Antonio and across Texas. The California-based company buys surplus shelf-stable inventory such as cereal, coffee, cookies, pasta, shampoo, and pet food that may have been tossed because of package updates, canceled orders, or seasonality. It goes into a warehouse, gets listed on Marty's mobile app and website, and then is shipped directly to customers. We are very excited to have launched in Texas, a strategically important market for us as we continue our expansion from the West Coast towards the East, co-founder Luis Fritofsen said in a statement. The company's minimum order is $20. Shipping is free for orders over $50, but otherwise is $5.99, and there is a $1.99 handling fee on every order. In addition to Texas, Marty ships to California, Oregon, Washington, Arizona, Nevada, Idaho, Utah, New Mexico, Colorado, Wyoming, and Montana, and has plans to ship nationwide by year end. At prices up to 70% off retail, shoppers save an average of $54 per order or $600 annually, Fritofsen said in an interview. Orders arrive in 1 to 3 days. This is number one, to make sure that people get access to more affordable foods, and number two, when you shop with Marty, you are doing the earth a favor as far as saving this food and making sure that it gets in the hands of people instead of going to a landfill, she said. The company is a preferred partner of national brands including Kind, Kellogg's, Quaker, and Annie's Homegrown. Fritofsen and co-founder Carrie Morris were entrepreneurs prior to starting Marty. They co-founded a multi-brand food company in 2019 but kept winding up with surplus items, Fritofsen said, which led us to think about this huge issue we have with food waste. They launched Marty in 2021 with $3 million in seed funding and have offices in Los Angeles and San Francisco. Fritofsen declined to share annual sales figures. The brands that customers see on Marty's website might differ from week to week because its stock changes depending on which of the brands it works with having an overage problem on any given week. Marty currently has about 500 products listed, but that will increase to roughly 1,500 by year end, Fritofsen said. The company does not sell expired items. It does sell short-coded goods or products with expiration dates that have not been reached but that will not be stocked by grocers because of concerns customers would not buy them before expiration, according to Marty. Asked whether the company is working with San Antonio-based HEB, Fritofsen said more to come on that. Our next article is titled Billionaire Shale Deal Just One of His Big Buys by Amanda Drain. For Jim Ratcliffe, breaking into Texas oil and gas business with $1.4 billion deal for Chesapeake Energy's Eagle Ford assets is a big move, but it's not his biggest. The billionaire founder of INEOS, a global chemicals business, also has Manchester United, one of England's most notable soccer clubs, in his sights. Ratcliffe, who submitted a second bid last month for Man U, joined a multi-billion dollar bidding war that is expected to reach as high as $6 billion and make the club the most expensive sports team in history, the Associated Press reported. Ratcliffe is also expanding INEOS and preparing for the U.S. launch of the Grenadier, a luxury off-road vehicle he poured $1 billion into developing after he identified a hole in the marketplace in 2017 and sought to fill it. The chairman and majority shareholder of Ineos, now based in Monaco, according to Bloomberg News, has a net worth of more than $23 billion, according to Forbes, with most of his business done under the company umbrella. The company said in a statement that it employs 26,000 people globally and generates about $65 billion annually in revenue. Ineos oversees the bulk of its energy industry business from headquarters in League City. The company said it has invested $21 billion in the U.S. and employs about 5,500 people here, largely in Texas. The deal with Oklahoma-based Chesapeake marks an expansion of Ineos's interest in Texas and its first foray into U.S. shale, giving it access to 2,300 wells in a shell play that stretches across the state. Chesapeake is divesting in the Eagle Ford as it shifts its focus toward the Haynesville and Marcellus plays in Louisiana and the Northeast, respectively. Ratcliffe is no stranger to Texas shale. In 2016, Ineos pioneered a fleet of so-called Dragon-class ships that opened a new market for ethane made from shale-borne natural gas as it built a network between Houston and European petrochemical companies. A chemical engineer by training, Ratcliffe began his career working within ExxonMobil's chemicals company and served as director of advanced materials at private equity group Advent International. After leading a series of chemical company buyouts, he founded Ineos in 1998 and bought BP's chemicals business for $9 billion. Ineos is now one of the world's largest chemical companies, and it has expanded far beyond its core business during the past decade. It bought luxury clothing brand Belstaff in 2017 and later branched into sports franchises such as French soccer club OGC Nice and Formula One racing team Mercedes AMG Petronas. A fan of off-roading, Ratcliffe launched his first off-road vehicle last year through Ineos Automotive. Was it a massive leap to become a car maker when he'd never done it before? It's a question asked of Ratcliffe in a video posted to the company's website. "No," Ratcliffe said. "It's just the belief that if you set your mind to do something, you can do it." Our next article is titled "Panhandle Explosions Kills 18,000 Cows." An explosion and fire at a dairy farm in the Texas Panhandle that killed more than 18,000 cows and injured a worker may be the deadliest barn blaze on record, wiping out almost 3% of the state's dairy herd. After subduing the fire at South Fork Dairy Farm, officials said they were stunned at the scale of livestock death left behind. The number of cows killed in holding pens where they waited to be milked was equal to 20% of the number slaughtered in America on any given day. A worker who was trapped inside the building was flown in critical condition to a hospital in Lubbock for treatment, officials said. His condition Friday was not available. The explosion and fire occurred Monday about 11 miles southeast of Dimmitt, midway between Lubbock and Amarillo. "It is mind-boggling," Dimmitt Mayor Roger Malone told USA Today. "I do not think it's ever happened before around here. It's a real tragedy." A spokesperson for the Texas Department of Insurance, which oversees the state fire marshal's office, said on Thursday that the explosion was under investigation and referred questions to Castro County Sheriff Salvador Rivera, who did not return calls. He told KCBD-TV in Lubbock the explosion apparently occurred when electrical equipment used to remove waste from the holding pens overheated and ignited methane. Investigators had not confirmed the cause on Friday. Photos and videos posted to social media showed massive plumes of black smoke rising from the farm. Castro County is the second highest milk-producing county in Texas, with 15 dairies producing about 11% of the state's 16.5 billion pounds of milk a year, according to the Texas Association of Dairymen. The state ranks fourth nationally in milk production and has an estimated 625,000 dairy cows. The magnitude of the blaze may be unmatched, according to the Washington, D.C.-based Animal Welfare Institute. This would be the most deadly fire involving cattle in the past decade since we started tracking that in 2013, spokeswoman Marjorie Fishman said on Thursday. The Institute, which tracks barn fires that kill other livestock, including poultry, pigs, goats, and sheep, said the deadliest it had recorded was a 2013 blaze in which 1 million chickens were killed at an egg production facility in southeast Indiana. A 2022 report by the Institute said there have been several fires that have killed from 100,000 to 400,000 chickens. In 2019, state officials authorized South Fork to more than double the number of cattle allowed on site from 11,500 to as many as 32,000, according to a permit with the Texas Commission on Environmental Quality. The state also authorized it to increase its manure production by more than 50% in that expanded permit. Wastewater from the facility drains into the Brazos River Basin. Our next article is titled Rates for Electricity Could Rise More Often by Kyra Buckley. A bill that would clear the way for more frequent rate hikes from electric utilities has advanced in the State House, buoyed by the passage of similar legislation in the Texas Senate. House Bill 3043, offered by North Texas Republican David Spiller, would allow utilities to seek a distribution cost rate increase twice a year, require companies to file for increases only with the Public Utility Commission, and would limit the PUC's review time to 60 days from the current 120 days. Supporters say the process is similar to the way utilities are recovering costs for building transmission projects approved by the state's grid operator. The Senate version, SB 1015, unanimously passed on April 5th. Backers of the bill say it will streamline the process for electric transmission and distribution utilities to recover costs for building and maintaining systems to deliver power to homes. Opponents say it removes oversight and will push up monthly electric bills for consumers. The measure does not apply to municipally owned utilities, so would not have direct impact on CPS Energy in San Antonio or Austin Energy in Austin. Regulated utilities such as CenterPoint Energy, which distributes electricity in the Houston area and elsewhere in Texas, are currently able to request increases once a year in bills to residential and business consumers to recoup money spent on delivering electricity called distribution costs. The charge shows up on residential electric bills as part of the per kilowatt hour fee passed on from utilities, sometimes called a delivery charge. To increase the rate, utilities must have the approval of both the municipality in which it operates and the Public Utility Commission, though the Commission has final say on the request. An order or decision is often handed down within 120 days. This simply makes the cost recovery system for the lines and poles from the substation to your house work the same way it does from the generator to the transmission lines, State Senator Phil King, a Tarrant County Republican and author of SB 1015, said in a committee hearing, which is frankly a less expensive, less administrative burdensome process and a faster process. But consumer advocates and city officials argue the current process strikes a balance between efficiency and protecting consumers. The proposed legislation, they say, will take review power away from cities while continuing to send consumer bills up. Cities have original jurisdiction in distribution rate cases, meaning it can request further information from the utility and challenge the inclusion of some investments in the rate. For example, said Tina Paez, Director of Administrative and Regulatory Affairs for the City of Houston, from 2015 to 2019, CenterPoint requested about $238 million, but had to knock nearly $80 million off because of challenges from the city. Baez said under the proposed legislation, cities would lose initial oversight of the request but could still participate in cases in more limited capacity. Consumer advocates say the proposal would pave the way for more frequent rate increases. Sandra Haverla, president of nonprofit advocacy group Texas Consumer Alliance, said because the legislation would shorten the PUC's review time to 60 days, it makes it hard for the public to participate in the process. Respondents have to be really up to speed, Haverla said, and participate quickly. The spokesperson for CenterPoint Energy, which lobbied for the bill, said in an email the proposed legislation would allow for more incremental changes on customer bills instead of large, less frequent changes. Utilities and other supporters of the legislation say it would also help companies focus on upgrading the electricity delivery system instead of working on drawn-out rate hike cases. We identified this bill as something that would allow us to get out of repetitive and inefficient processes, Jason Ryan, Executive Vice President of Regulatory Services and Government Affairs at CenterPoint, said during the Senate committee hearing. Our next article is titled Parking Areas Compromise Walkability of Downtown by Timothy Fanning. San Antonio boasts an impressive number of parking lots and garages, enough to push the percentage of land they consume above most major metropolitan areas across the country, according to data compiled by a nonprofit working for parking reform across the United States. About 26% of downtown San Antonio's surface area is reserved for cars, according to analysis by the Parking Reform Network. It said that realty is comprising the area's walkability. It is clear that if we want to have walkable cities, we need cities that are less parkable, the organization said on its website. On average, 20% of the land in the 50 city centers it analyzed was dedicated solely to parking. An abundant supply of parking infrastructure also creates a scarcity of reusable land for other purposes, the network said. That can contribute to increased housing costs, lower population density, and greater sprawl. A low parking score means the city devotes much less land in its central neighborhoods to parking than the average, the study reads. Conversely, a high score translates to more land dedicated to parking compared to the average for a city of that size. Among the 50 cities analyzed, Arlington's score indicated it had the most land devoted to parking, while San Francisco had the lowest. Just 17% of downtown Austin is dedicated to parking lots or garages. Parking garages built recently in San Antonio and elsewhere are more utilitarian than most have been in years past. Some are being designed more thoughtfully with security and ease of use for drivers at top of mind. Some of the changes come from more stringent city zoning that requires amenities such as street-level retail and designs that blend with the surrounding neighborhood, but other changes are the result of clients' desire to put their best foot forward. The trend can be seen in several buildings outside of downtown San Antonio, including the Breckenridge Park parking garage near the Whitty Museum, the Tobin Center garage, and the New York Zoo, the San Antonio Zoo garage on Tuleta, and a planned garage at University Health System Women's and Children's Hospital in the South Texas Medical Center. The Parking Reform Network said downtown areas in general face the most pressure from high levels of land use for parking. This parking is often clustered around main streets, office districts, and historic cores, creating a barrier around the city's most valuable and walkable areas that limits residential and commercial growth, it said. Our next article is titled IBEX Global is Closing San Antonio Call Centers by Patrick Danner. IBEX Global Solutions Incorporated is closing its San Antonio call center in June, affecting 227 employees. Most will be offered employment at the company's New Braunfels call center or given the opportunity to work from home, the company said in a March 31st letter to the Texas Workforce Commission. IBEX offered no reason for shuttering the center at 12449 Silicon Drive, but notified the state under the Worker Adjustment and Retraining Act, or WARN Act, which requires companies to give notice of mass layoffs. IBEX provides customer care, sales, and marketing services for its clients. It is a subsidiary of IBEX Limited, a public company that trades on the NASDAQ and is incorporated in Bermuda. The parent company's executive management office is based in Washington, D.C. Paul Inson, IBEX Global's chief people officer, said in the letter it anticipates some San Antonio employees will be laid off beginning as early as late May because they have not been offered or accepted another job with the company. The closing of the San Antonio call center is slated to begin June 2nd or within 13 days of that date, he said. We have valued and appreciated being part of the San Antonio business community and will support our employees in their job transition, Inson added. IBEX joins a growing list of companies that have announced layoffs in recent months. Last month, San Antonio cloud computing company Rackspace Technology announced the elimination of 275 positions, or 4% of its workforce, in response to a broad economic downturn. It would not say how many in its local workforce should be let go. More than 800 workers will lose their jobs May 1st when the 327-bed Texas Vista Medical Center on the southwest side closes. New Braunfels-based TaskUs in February said it would cut 186 jobs in the San Antonio area as the provider of outsourced digital services continues cutting its U.S. workforce while expanding globally. Tech giants that have offices in Central and South Texas also have announced downsizing since the start of the new year. Google, Microsoft, Amazon, and Facebook parent Meta have all said they would lay off employees. IBEX arrived in San Antonio in 2014 to fanfare with the announcement it would create 1,000 jobs. The Northwest Side Call Center was to be IBEX's largest Texas presence and its 10th U.S. location, the U.S. San Antonio Express News reported at the time. Its expansion to San Antonio came about a year after it announced its first call center in the metro area at the former Scooter Store headquarters in New Braunfels. It said it planned to hire more than 750 people there. A little more than 2 years ago, IBEX disclosed plans to cut 248 jobs at that facility. IBEX Limited, it has a global workforce of more than 30,000 people. The company said in an October Securities and Exchange Commission filing that it has been shifting operations to offshore and north shore locations, investing in additional facilities in Jamaica, Nicaragua, Honduras, and the Philippines. It earned almost $23 million on nearly $494 million in revenue in its latest fiscal year ended June 30th. You have been listening to business news on Owl Radio. You can listen to Owl Radio on our specially tuned radio or by streaming on your computer or smartphone. You may also listen at your convenience on our podcast page at www.owlradio.org. Thank you for listening. This program will be replayed after 9 p.m. this evening. This is Vanessa saying goodbye from Owl Radio.